How did China transform itself from a poor country into one of the largest economies in the world in just 30 years? To answer that question, American futurist John Naisbitt and his wife Doris established the Naisbitt China Institute in North China's Tianjin province in 2006. John Naisbitt still remembers how China was when he first went there more than 40 years ago.
Unbelievably primitive in the 60s and 70s. And to spend time there now with the most modern cities in the world, the most modern transportation in the world, it's just very hard to comprehend. How did they do it?
To discover the secret of China's rapid transformation, the 28 staff members of the Naisbitt's China Institute were asked to monitor the local media, newspapers, radio, television, the internet.
To get a picture of what is going on in China, we had to monitor all of China, all the provinces. We had to monitor local news. You know, here's a new school, here the farmers are creating a cultural center. Whatever little things would then make the big picture.
One part of that picture, Doris Naisbitt says, is how smoothly China has been moving from rigid communism to a form of capitalism ever since the reforms instituted in the 1980s by the late Chinese premier Deng Xiaoping.
I would say communism is a leftover from the time before Deng Xiaoping. There is a certain connection to communism, which is a totally different one than we as Western people think. One of the sayings that Deng Xiaoping is famous for, it doesn't matter what color the cat has, whether it's black or white, as long as it catches mice. They understood very well that communism did not serve them. Central planning could not bring China out of poverty, and it was an extremely backward and poor country 30 years ago, and that they had to put in the market and capitalism to give the people the opportunity to do whatever they are talented in to really get China's economy going.
That's what the Naisbitts call the emancipation of the mind, one of the eight pillars of China's new society that they describe in their new book, China's Megatrends.
Deng Xiaoping said, I can't do it, the government can't do it, only the people can do it, and we have to move from indoctrination to emancipation. And one of the pillars we have is we call framing the forest and letting the trees grow. In other words, the government frames what's possible and what's to be done, like the special economic zones, but then the people in that frame can contribute however they want to contribute, because it all comes from the people.
John Naisbitt calls Deng Xiaoping the founder of the new China.
He's the father and the godfather of this modern China. Because remember, it followed the Cultural Revolution. Some people are beginning to think, and I'm beginning to agree with them, that the Cultural Revolution, horrible as it was, really prepared the ground for the new China. Because it was so bad that once the people were liberated and released to enhance their own lives, they really went for it.
Other pillars in China's new society, the Naisbitts contend, include giving artists and intellectuals the lead in cultivating the people's minds and senses, balancing what's economically possible and socially desirable, playing a new political role in the global community, and encouraging economic experimentation.
Crossing the river by feeling the stones, it was a trial and error concept. You're feeling your way across and you feel the stones, so you shift your course. Maybe you back up a little bit and you go forward. And that's what they've been doing. And, you know, they started with the free economic zones. And they had all kinds of ideas with no taxes for a while and special compensations about trade and so forth. See how it worked. And those things that really worked, they went with, and the other things they dismissed as they moved on feeling their way.
And Doris Naisbitt notes that China has also chosen to create its own form of democracy.
We call what is developing in China a vertical democracy because of its structure of bottom-up and top-down, top-down directions and bottom-up initiatives. Over time, China's Communist Party has to say goodbye to the name Communist Party because it doesn't reflect what the party really is.
While the Nesbitts point to the new freedoms in Chinese society, such as a focus on creative thinking in education and greater women's rights, other China watchers note that Beijing still maintains tight control over the practice of religion, the judicial system, and the media, including the public's access to the Internet. And the Chinese government's record on human rights, especially its treatment of ethnic Tibetan and Uyghur populations, continues to draw widespread criticism from rights groups and the international community. But such concerns have not slowed Beijing's extraordinary advance into the global marketplace. China recently became the world's largest exporter, passing Germany, and is expected to soon become the second largest economy in the world, passing Japan. Those developments, Nesbitt says, should encourage the world to look to China as an opportunity, not a threat.
If a country sees China as a threat, they feed the idea that they should keep their distance, hold it off, and they won't benefit as we all move toward integrating all of the economies of the world. And that's clearly the direction we're going. One economy for the whole world. You want to be both competitive and cooperative at the same time with China. Pick your ways of doing it, but seize the opportunity that China presents to the whole world.
John Nesbitt says if China was able to transform itself so dramatically over the last 30 years, the world can expect it to continue maturing as it becomes an increasingly active player in the global community. I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News, Washington.